apartment because her 93-year-old, I believe, grandfather, certainly a very elderly grandfather, was a double amputee. He couldn't easily get down to the basement bomb shelter. You know, I think, you know, everybody can understand that very human desire to be with your loved ones, not to leave them alone. And when the force of the explosion hit it, it picked up a door, it tore it off its hinges, and it slammed it into her
face.
Wait
5 seconds. Emma, we want to thank you for being with us. Emma Graham Harrison works for The Guardian. We'll link to her recent coverage from Kharkiv. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is Roxanne Delgar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
Come on over to Rhythm Shack with Mike Fisher for high energy roots rock, Americana, jam bands, blues, and more. Every second and fifth Monday from 3 to 5:30 a.m. That's Rhythm Shack here on 90.7 FM. KBOO Portland and KBOO.FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Prosecutors say the driver who killed four unhoused people in Salem had a blood alcohol level nearly twice the legal limit. The FDA authorizes a second COVID-19 booster shot for Americans age 50 and older. And in international news, Russia's military says it will cut back operations to increase trust in peace talks with Ukraine. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 29th, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The man who allegedly drove into a camp of unhoused people in Salem early Sunday morning had roughly double the legal limit of alcohol in his blood. The driver, 24-year-old Enrique Rodriguez Jr., was booked into Marion County Jail on Monday without bail. He's being charged with four counts of first-degree manslaughter, second-degree assault, reckless driving, and driving while under the influence of intoxicants. The crash occurred at 2 a.m. Sunday when the driver slammed into an encampment in the area of Front and Division Streets. Two people died at the scene, and four people were hospitalized with life-threatening injuries, two later dying of their wounds at the hospital. Authorities identified those killed as 24-year-old Joe and Beck, 21-year-old Luke Cagey, 54-year-old Joe Posada III, and 29-year-old Rochelle Zamacona. According to a charging document filed with the Marion County Circuit Court, Rodriguez had a blood alcohol content of 0.15. A level of 0.08 or higher constitutes driving under the influence, according to Oregon law. In Portland, city officials issued an emergency declaration last month banning camping in high crash areas after a Portland Bureau of Transportation crash report for 2021 found one in three traffic death victims were people who were unhoused. A preliminary report by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission found people released early from prison due to the COVID-19 pandemic have not shown a spike of recidivism. Between July of 2020 and October of 2021, Oregon Governor Kate Brown commuted the sentences of 963 people, mostly considered medically vulnerable or nearing the end of their sentences. The Criminal Justice Commission, a nonpartisan state agency, looked at the first 260 people granted release between July and November of 2020. The agency found 18% were arrested within 1 year of their commutation, 8% were convicted of a new crime, and 2% were reincarcerated. Commission Executive Director Ken Sanchagrin said those numbers are similar to figures from 2019 involving people granted release or parole. Sanchagrin said, quote, "It doesn't appear that being let out early for these folks had any type of negative impact as far as higher rates of recidivism that we would normally expect," end quote. Brown has faced criticism over the pandemic-related commutations. In January, two district attorneys in Oregon filed a complaint, alleging the governor went outside the bounds of her executive powers to issue the commutations. The Criminal Justice Commission will issue another report on those released early due to the pandemic sometime in the next year. Oregon will no longer require people to be residents of the state to use its law allowing terminally ill people to choose to end their own lives. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
Oregon is eliminating its requirement for terminally ill patients wishing to use death with dignity to be state residents. A recent lawsuit challenged the requirement as unconstitutional, and in a settlement filed in U.S. District Court in Portland yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Medical Board agreed to stop enforcing the residency requirement and to ask the legislature to remove it from the law. Advocates plan to use the settlement to encourage other states where death with dignity is legal to drop their residency requirements as well. Kevin Diaz, an attorney with Compassion and Choices, said, quote, "This requirement was both discriminatory and profoundly unfair to dying patients at the most critical time of their life," end quote. However, Laura Echeverria, a spokeswoman for National Right to Life, says Oregon risks becoming the nation's, quote, "assisted suicide tourism capital," end quote. Safeguards against that latter possibility still remain, since it is extremely difficult for terminally ill people to make extended trips to other states, and because many people want to die in the presence of loved ones at home. Compassion and Choices sued on behalf of Dr. Nicholas Gideons, a Portland family practice physician who had been unable to write prescriptions for terminal patients who live in Washington state. Washington also has a medical aid in dying statute, but finding providers, at least in the southwestern part of the state, was difficult. The lawsuit argued that the residency requirement violated the U.S. Constitution's Commerce Clause, which gives Congress the right to regulate interstate commerce, as well as the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which forbids states from discriminating against citizens from other states in favor of its own residents. Oregon was the first state to enact death with dignity legislation. Since the law took effect and was first used in 1998, more than 2,100 people in Oregon have chosen to end their own lives rather than suffer through a terminal illness. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Russia's deputy defense minister said Moscow would drastically reduce its military presence near Ukraine's capital of Kyiv as Russian and Ukrainian delegations met in Turkey on Tuesday for a new round of peace talks. Russian deputy defense minister Alexander Fomin made the announcement in an on-camera statement from Istanbul, saying Moscow would also reduce its military presence north of Kyiv. However, Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said officials believe the movement is, quote, "likely more a repositioning to be used elsewhere in Ukraine," end quote. Kirby warned that Russia could possibly launch a major offensive against other areas of Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken cast doubt on Russia's pledge to cut back on hostilities, adding, quote, "There is what Russia says and there is what Russia does. We're focused on the latter, and what Russia is doing is the continued brutalization of Ukraine and its people. And that continues as we speak," end quote. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky had previously said he was willing to discuss his country's neutrality to bring an end to the war. However, over the weekend, he stressed that he would not sacrifice Ukraine's territorial integrity. On the ground, the British defense minister said Ukrainian forces were seeing some success with localized counterattacks to the northwest of Kyiv, including in the city of Irpin, where local officials said they had driven out Russian forces. However, the Russian military still poses a significant threat to the capital of Kyiv through their strike capability. Ukrainian negotiators involved in peace talks with Russia in Istanbul on Tuesday said they want to see an international agreement under which other nations would act as guarantors of Ukraine's security. He said guarantor countries could include United Nations Security Council member states, including the U.S., U.K., China, Russia, and France, as well as other countries such as Turkey, Canada, Germany, Italy, Poland, and Israel. According to the UN Refugee Agency, more than 3.9 million Ukrainians have fled to neighboring countries, with millions more displaced inside Ukraine. The UN said at least 1,100 civilians have been killed and almost 2,000 injured since the start of the war. Experts have warned that the true numbers are likely far higher. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration announced Tuesday that they are authorizing a second COVID-19 booster shot for Americans age 50 and older. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention still has to sign off on the booster before it becomes available, and it's not clear how soon that may happen. The FDA said a second booster dose improves protection against severe COVID-19 and is not associated with new safety concerns. According to the FDA's decision, people 50 and over who received a booster shot of any approved COVID-19 vaccine more than 4 months ago can get a second Pfizer, BioNTech, or Moderna booster at no cost. In addition, anyone 12 or older with a weakened immune system because of medical treatment or conditions are also eligible for an additional shot aimed to provide them the same level of protection someone with a healthy immune system received after 3 doses. For the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, the booster will be identical to all previous shots, while the Moderna booster contains half the original dose. Although the initial 2-dose vaccine provides protection against hospitalization and death, a booster shot has been shown to be better at preventing severe infection from the Omicron variant that emerged near the end of last year. Some data suggests a second booster shot would help combat fading immunity even after the 3rd shot. The FDA said, quote, "The known and potential benefits of a second COVID-19 vaccine booster dose with either of these vaccines outweigh their known and potential risks in these populations," end quote. President Joe Biden on Tuesday signed into law a historic bill that makes lynching a federal hate crime in the U.S. for the first time. The Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act was signed into law today, more than 100 years after such a legislation was first proposed. The bill is named for Emmett Till, a 14-year-old black boy whose brutal torture and killing in Mississippi in 1955 became a galvanizing moment in the civil rights era. His grieving mother, Mamie Till Mobley, insisted on an open casket to show the world how her son had been brutalized. Biden acknowledged the long delay during remarks to lawmakers and civil rights advocates, stressing how the violent deaths of black Americans were used to intimidate them and prevent them from voting simply because of their skin color. The president also stressed that forms of racial terror continue to exist in the U.S. today, creating the need for the law. The bill makes it possible to prosecute a crime as a lynching when a conspiracy to commit a hate crime leads to death or serious bodily injury. The law lays out a maximum sentence of 30 years in prison, as well as monetary fines. After it unanimously cleared the Senate, the House approved the bill on March 7th, 422-3, with 8 members not voting. Congress first considered anti-lynching legislation more than 120 years ago. It had failed to pass such legislation nearly 200 times, beginning with a bill introduced in 1900 by North Carolina Representative George Henry White, the only black member of Congress at the time. More than 4,000 people, mostly black Americans, were reported lynched in the U.S. from 1882 to 1968 in 12 southern states. According to the Equal Justice Initiative, 99% of perpetrators of lynching escaped state or local punishment. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio, featuring a presentation by Dr. Dominic Della Sala, chief scientist at Wild Heritage and former president of the Society for Conservation Biology, about the importance of mature and old-growth forests as carbon reserves and the unique carbon and biodiversity characteristics of the Tongass Rainforest. Then at 6, it's Preference. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 57 degrees. Today in history, in 1973, The last U.S. combat troops leave South Vietnam, and the last remaining American prisoners of war held in North Vietnam are freed. America's direct 8-year intervention in the Vietnam War comes to an end. The Vietnam War was the longest and most unpopular foreign war in U.S. history and cost the lives of 58,000 American soldiers and as many as 2 million Vietnamese soldiers and civilians. The quote of the day is from American politician and diplomat John Kerry, who said, quote, "I saw courage both in the Vietnam War and in the struggle to stop it. I learned that patriotism includes protest, not just military service." President Joe Biden unveils his 2023 budget. The January 6th committee considers contempt charges against two Trump advisors, and nearly half of Americans are very concerned Russia may target the U.S. with nuclear weapons. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The budget puts more police on the street for community policing, so they get to know the community they're policing.
President Biden unveiled his 2023 budget request to Congress Monday, asking for more funding for community safety and police training. The proposal also includes a 20% minimum tax on all U.S. households with an income of $100 million or greater, including unrealized gains in the value of liquid assets like stocks. Democratic California Representative Ro Khanna.
It's high time that people who have made billions of dollars pay the same taxes as people who are in service jobs.
The president also said he's not walking back comments he made over the weekend, declaring Russian President Vladimir Putin should not remain in power. The January 6th committee met Monday to consider criminal contempt charges against two former advisors of President Trump, Peter Navarro and Dan Scavino, who are refusing to hand over information. Committee Chairman and Mississippi Democratic Representative Benny G. Thompson.
So now they are saying they won't answer any of our questions because of executive privilege. There are a couple of big problems with their argument.
In a civil case subpoena surrounding the January 6th committee, U.S. District Judge David Carter said he found it more likely than not former President Trump and his legal advisor, John Eastman, committed multiple federal crimes in their effort to prevent Congress from certifying President Biden's 2020 election victory. The ruling has no direct bearing on whether Trump will face criminal charges. The Senate Judiciary Committee will vote on Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's nomination April 4th. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin.
She was, in short, a model for judicial temperament, a virtue which all of us in public life should aspire to.
Nearly half of Americans say they are very concerned Russia may target the U.S. with nuclear weapons. According to a new Associated Press and the University of Chicago poll, Georgetown University government professor and national security strategist Matthew Kranig on the nuclear threat posed by Putin.
I think the risk is remote, but it's not zero.
Roughly 9 in 10 Americans say they are at least somewhat concerned Putin might use a nuclear weapon against Ukraine. In the Middle East Monday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with ministers from the UAE, Israel, Bahrain, Morocco, and Egypt. The meeting comes after the Abraham Accords in 2020, which paved the way for neighboring countries to normalize ties with Israel.
The Abraham Accords are making the lives of people across your countries more peaceful, more prosperous, more vibrant, more integrated.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The first group of Canada's Indigenous delegates and residential school survivors have met in Rome with Pope Francis. And President Joe Biden's fiscal year 2023 budget asks for investments in Indian country. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The first group of Canada's Indigenous delegates and residential school survivors have met with Pope Francis in Rome. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, they're hoping to secure an apology for the role of the Catholic Church in Canada's residential school system.
It's a week-long event, with members of the Métis Nation and Inuit having met with the Pope on Monday. The president of the Métis National Council, Cassidy Caron, says she asked the Pope to join her people on their journey for truth, reconciliation, healing, and justice, adding that he acknowledged that as his personal responsibility. Caron was joined by several residential school survivors who told the Pope their stories. The Catholic Church operated scores of the government-funded residential schools across the country. As many as 150,000 Native children were forced to attend the schools. Thousands were abused. Many died. Natan Obed is the president of the Inuit Tapiret Kanatami. He also met with the Pope and says an apology is immensely important.
Apologies matter, and they might not be the same thing to every single person who is being apologized to, but really the idea is that on a human level, the Church acknowledges the human rights abuses, the pain and suffering, the intergenerational trauma, and cares enough about Indigenous people to make that apology, even if some people won't accept it.
In addition to a public apology, delegates want the Church to return Indigenous artifacts and land, provide funding to help survivors heal, and provide access to Church records about the schools. This visit comes after as many as 2,000 possible unmarked graves were found at several former residential school sites in the past year. First Nations delegates are scheduled to meet with the Pope on Thursday. Expectations are high that the Pope will travel to Canada at some point to make an apology. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The philanthropist Mackenzie Scott has announced gifts to hundreds of organizations, adding up to nearly $4 billion. Alice Fordham reports one gift is set to transform a New Mexico nonprofit serving Native American elders around the country.
The National Indian Council on Aging, headquartered in Albuquerque, received a gift of $4 million from Scott, who is the former wife of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. Executive Director Larry Curley of the Navajo Nation says the gift was astounding.
I'm excited. The staff are excited. And it's, quite frankly, it's the largest donation that the organization has ever received in its 40 years of existence.
Curley says the group is brainstorming how best to spend the money to further his organization's work of supporting elders from Native communities across the country. He says one issue that's a priority is communication in places where internet-based support isn't an option.
We're looking at the possibility of creating a 24/7 crisis call center for our tribal elders.
Curley says the gift opens up horizons for the organization, which strives to help a group with high levels of poverty and stark healthcare disparities compared with the wider population of the U.S. For National Native News, I'm Alice Fordham.
President Biden's fiscal year 2023 budget request invests in Indian country to address missing and murdered Indigenous people and help address gender-based violence. The budget proposes more than $600 million in tribal public safety and justice funding at the Interior Department to continue to address MMIP in collaboration with the Justice Department. It also includes $35 million to support underserved and tribal communities for culturally specific programs to address violence against women, and nearly $70 million for the FBI to address violent crime against children in Indian country. Other areas for tribes in the budget, which was released Monday, include healthcare, education, housing, and broadband. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Efforts to end Russia's war on Ukraine have intensified in recent days as Ukrainian and Russian negotiators began peace talks in Istanbul, Turkey on Tuesday. Putin's invasion has not gone to plan, with the Ukrainian army and government not collapsing in the immediate aftermath of Russian troops entering the country. In addition, Russia's offensive has stalled in many areas. NATO has made clear it will not get involved in the war directly by enforcing a no-fly zone over Ukraine or by deploying troops, meaning it's extremely unlikely Russia will suffer an outright military defeat. That signifies the conflict is likely to end either through a peaceful resolution or through prolonged conflict. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
How will it end? In the wake of Ukraine's stunning and stubborn resistance to Putin's invasion, The question whose answer once seemed preordained now can be asked in all seriousness. The war, now a month old, might go on for many more months, or it could end in an agreement between Moscow and Kyiv. Four considerations influence all the potential outcomes. One is Putin's character. He displays all the worst features of a dictator: uncompromising, self-assured, isolated, insecure, and hateful. He has already fired or arrested some of his top intelligence people. We see him lecturing his chief advisors like a medieval king might deal with underlings. Most relevant to the war is that Putin demands a win. The Russian leadership can't lose, said a director of a research organization close to the Russian government. No matter what, they will need to end this whole story with some kind of victory. Second, quick victory is no longer possible for Russia. Even victory after prolonged bombing and occupation of some territory seems implausible. The Russian military has taken heavy losses of life and equipment. Its main forces bogged down. Its air force does not command the skies. In a word, the Ukraine campaign has become a massive intelligence and battlefield failure for Putin. Third, international sanctions on Russia have taken a steep toll on its economy, its reputation, and Putin's once-upon-a-time admirers. We have it from none other than Sergei Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, that, quote, when the reserves of the central bank were frozen, no one would think, out of those who made predictions, what sanctions the West might apply. The sanctions have dramatically reduced the ruble's value, cut Russia's roughly $625 billion in foreign exchange reserves in half, and caused most international businesses in Russia to flee. Russia could be a pauper by the time the war ends. Fourth, there are no voices against the war around Putin. No major resignation of officials, no backlash from the military, no oligarchs protesting, no Chinese pressure, and of course, no mass popular protests. With those four circumstances in mind, what outcomes are possible? One is a unilateral step by Putin that would be coupled with a triumphant statement. We should keep in mind that not all wars end in agreement. Exhaustion on one or both sides can lead to withdrawal of forces without a settlement, or, as in the Korean War, the parties can create an indefinite ceasefire. Putin might remove his forces from most of Ukraine, but hold on to the Donbas in the east and its two so-called People's Republics without ever signing an agreement. Diplomacy is much the preferred way to end this war, but any possibility of an agreed ending is likely to require painful concessions by President Zelensky in order to rid Ukraine of Russian military forces. The concessions might be a declaration of neutrality and acceptance of formal autonomy for the two Donbas provinces, all of which would be legitimized in the Ukraine constitution. His acknowledgement of Russian control of Crimea might also be necessary. In return, Putin would have to withdraw completely from occupied territory and formally claim, as Russia once did in 1994, respect for the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. Putin would also agree to remove all regular or irregular military forces from Donbas. Moreover, Russia should provide compensation for the horrific damage it has caused to life and property in Ukraine, perhaps as part of a UN-administered relief fund that would also enable Ukrainian refugees to return home. Would Putin agree to these terms? Would Zelensky? Obviously, Ukraine neutrality and an end to the NATO membership issue would be fine with Putin. Legitimizing his seizure of Crimea and Donbas would give him a partial but significant victory. As for Zelensky, he must determine the degree of compromise he can condone and that Ukraine citizens will accept. He will have to measure the imperatives of an unjust peace against those of a just but devastating war. The authors of those words propose that the U.S. and NATO offer security guarantees to Ukraine in place of NATO membership and of relying on Russian good faith, as happened after the Budapest Declaration in 1994. Three items should be off the table in any Ukraine-Russia agreement. One is Russian war crimes. Another is prosecution of Putin and other Russian officials before the International Criminal Court. And a third is sanctions relief. The first two are legal matters that may or may not be pursued. As for sanctions relief, any discussion of them should only come in separate talks between the European Union, NATO, and Russia. Sanctions should be lifted step by step with Russian adherence to its agreement with Ukraine. When the last Russian soldier, tank, and jet leaves Ukraine, sanctions can be put on the table. Not a moment sooner. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 29th, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Romlagon, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give. Or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Hey everybody, thank you for tuning into Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. Today we are sharing with you a special presentation by Dr. Dominic De La Sala to the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance about the Tongass National Forest and natural climate solutions.
Thanks everyone so much for joining tonight. We have for you a special Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance event. My name is Sam Kropp. I am a steering committee member with the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance. And if you don't know who we are a growing network of organizers and community members who are deeply committed to working at the intersection of forest defense and climate defense in the grassroots community. We're here to discuss a topic that's very near and dear to many of our hearts here in the Pacific Northwest. And that topic is Alaska's incredible Tongass National Forest. And as many of us know, the Tongass National Forest is an incredible place. It's home to ancient trees, threatened species, and it holds over 40% of all of the forest carbon stored by national forests. And so tonight's event is going to be an exploration of that history, that context, all of the incredible aspects of the Tongass National Forest, and basically where things are going from here in the campaign to protect it. And to have that conversation, we are